Well, thank you, Dean and panellists. Good morning, everyone. I'm Virginia Christie. In facilitating this morning's discussion, I thought it would be quite a nice start to have a discussion around China and the global economy, because that always presents a nice backdrop for conditions domestically. Before we do that, I would also like you to have a little think about some questions you might like to ask, because there's some very big economic issues and proposed policy responses around those, and we're really not going to get the time to cover them today, so take that opportunity if you'd like. Jared, so let's start with you in a discussion on China. Let's put the coronavirus to one side for the moment and focus on more medium to longer term structural challenges that China's facing. One is that it's facing a trend decline in its economic growth rate, which is a normal progression as the economy continues to develop and goes through the back end of that industrialization phase. So an expected development, but it's happening. And the other major challenge is demographics and the slowing in the population growth. So given that China is our major trading partner, should we be concerned?
Thanks for that. I have to say I remain an optimist, certainly over the medium to longer term on China. I think one, as you say, it is a, you know, it's normal to expect that over a period of time a country's growth will slow when you've seen such a rapid acceleration over such a long period of time. And 6% on the size of the economic base that China has is still incredible growth. I think I also, when I look at GDP per capita numbers compared to advanced economies, there's still such a long way to run, in terms of the growth of the middle class and living standards. So that gives me some optimism around demand, for example, for our commodities and services. I also feel confident in the face of some of those demographic pressures, because I think the real growth story in decades to come is going to be around technology. So many countries, particularly advanced economies, are going to be dealing with issues around ageing, but technology is going to be a big part of the answer to future growth. China, in an area like artificial intelligence, in the last years, because of its scale and its human capital, has been able to accelerate its developments in that area and be a real world leader in such a quick period of time. So I think, you know, those sorts of things, to me, can offset some of the impacts around the ageing population. I'm also quite confident in the fact that the Chinese government will take steps and intervene in the economy where they need to. And I think we've seen that in recent, over at least the last decade, where they've not been afraid to come in with stimulus. And it is so important to keep continuous growth and not fall into negative territory, which I think over the longer term has a really bolstering impact on growth. So. Okay.
And on that very point, the coronavirus, clearly it's having a pretty major effect, not only on China, but on the global economy, now that the virus has really spread external to China. Can we think about the mechanisms, the channels and the flows in which an event like this within China might flow and feed through to the global economy? So that it's proposed that there are four channels, that there are people flows, supply chains, trade and commodity prices, and asset prices. So if they're the channels, you may or may not agree, what do you think the biggest impact is going to be through those channels on the Australian economy?
So good question. I do like the advice of the Reserve Bank Governor a few weeks ago when he said that we should remain calm. And you'd probably expect me to agree with the Reserve Bank Governor. But there is a need, I think, to take kind of the deluge of information that we're getting day to day and just kind of filter through and put some of it in perspective. Clearly, the most immediate impact we've seen is the people channel, and we're seeing that in terms of tourism and international education. Chinese tourists spend $12 billion a year in Australia, about $350 million in WA. So clearly those areas in a quarter, the March quarter, which is the most popular period for visits, that's going to have a short-term impact. But I think the broader global macroeconomic impacts are the ones that we need to be more concerned about, and that will take a lot longer to come through in the data, and that is the disruption to supply chains. We've seen Australian companies like Cochlear announcing profit warnings. We've also seen some of the South Korean manufacturers shutting down operations. And then we look at what's happening in asset markets and commodity markets. So I think the longer this goes on, you might start to see issues around demand globally, and that will impact commodity prices. Obviously, in the last couple of days, asset markets, and it's incredible to think that asset markets have not reacted until now, really, in such a dramatic way. I think if you think about what might happen for Australia in that, you know, US decides to reduce interest rates through the year, and that means that our dollar will appreciate. And so that mechanism that's been a really strong you know, asset for the Australian economy recently, having a lower Australian dollar and more competitive exports, is taken away. So I think there's going to be a lot of those sorts of transmission mechanisms that we're going to see over coming months.
Yeah, and interestingly, I think that some of those big supply side disruptions haven't really been factored into the official forecasts yet. So we should really brace ourselves for further downward revisions to the forecast. Anyway, we'll see how that plays out. Amber Jade, I wouldn't mind picking up on the whole issue of having experienced a shock, and this is a particular shock. There are likely to be more to come in the system. So what this means is that we need to future-proof Western Australia, as you pointed out in your presentation. We need to make our economy more resilient, and diversification is the issue that the panel has raised. So perhaps you can give us some more details about the state government's blueprint to diversify the economy by 2025 and some of the challenges around that as well.
Sure. When we took office around 3 years ago, it seemed obvious that there were a number of industries that hadn't been prioritised, that had potential. Some of those industries like tourism and defence. And we've launched a very aggressive attempt to the submarine, full docking cycle submarines to WA as part of that plan. We're obviously increasing our capacity for manufacturing with opening the centre in Midland to support our Metronet rail line and our natural resources in lithium. So it's important that we don't just rely on the resources sector to stabilise the budget, because it is so volatile, as been pointed out by all speakers, and that we're actually looking across those industries. Okay. And we're doing that in a number of ways, by sitting down with those industries, talking to them, asking people in the sector, what do you need, what do you want from government? And that may be funding, it may be facilitating a range of different things. And we're also implementing our Asian engagement strategy, and I outlined a number of the trade delegations to diversify our trading partners as well as the industries. And in the housing sector, I think Dean pointed out quite rightly that the housing sector is struggling and has been for some time. And we sat down with the sector and had discussions with them about what they saw as being some of the solutions. One of those was the cutting of the stamp duty to apartments. We also announced a huge investment in social housing to be built, and lowered the income levels for Key Start loans, as well as increasing their loan book. So there is a range of levers government has, policy levers, and we're certainly active in looking at that. And I think one of the benefits of having that stability in government is that we can be outward looking and talking to business and talking to the community in the sector, and really in a dialogue about what it is we need to put in place as a state.
Okay, so quite a few proposals are being put on the table there. Dean, can I bring you into the conversation? Clearly you're an advocate of diversification as well. Is there anything more that you would propose? Is there an angle? Is there a particular part of industry that you think needs further focus on diversification?
as I shared, I believe we've got to drive, and using technology, drive cheaper energy through Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
If we embrace technology and innovation, and what ultimately flows from that is a lot of automation, we have a chance to do greater downstream processing of our mineral wealth. And I'm not talking on the bulk commodities, I'm talking the high end. I believe that there are opportunities there, but we must deliver cheaper energy. We have an abundance of wind, we have an abundance of sun, we have natural, you know, all the resources available, so plenty of gas in Western Australia, but we've got to make sure that it's available and cheap for industry to create real jobs.
Okay, and in terms of industry diversification, I'm thinking of there are proposals around to value add in our traditional industries where we have a comparative advantage. Is it an idea to focus on those types of industries, or do you think we're kind of narrowing it down too far and potentially picking winners?
I think, I was fortunate, and I know members of both sides have travelled Israel to see it, how they're encouraging innovation and how they're encouraging startups and things like that. We don't want to just restrict ourselves to existing industries and to spread across. We need to look at new technology and what that drives and be on the forefront of change.
Okay.
And so therefore I think there are greater opportunities across the board. Whilst I think there are large opportunities for improving productivity within the existing industries, and the important thing from a government perspective is to create the environment or make sure the environment's there that allows industry to get on with it. Often governments have got to get out the way just as much as creating an environment. We've got to let industry get on with it.
Okay. I think we'll take the conversation to the outlook. We'll bring you into the conversation, John. You said $160 billion worth of projects underway or planned. That's quite significant. And the thing that is encouraging about that stat is that if you look at the makeup of the economy, the biggest component is consumption, but the biggest driver of the cycles, either the upswing or the downswing, is investment. So that's encouraging. You also identified some of the key disconnects, I guess, in the economy: low wages growth, low retail sales and the like. And the other is confidence, that confidence indicators don't appear to be responding to the expectation that we're about to go through this upswing. So what's your view on that? Could that derail the recovery? Could it have any impact at all? It may not have any impact, but what's your view on that?
Well, taking that the last part of your question first around confidence, I've been a keen observer of confidence indicators for many years, and in a past life with the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, where we developed up a range of confidence indicators, and they do fundamentally influence the shape and direction of the economy. From a consumption or an investment business perspective, I think consumer confidence largely comes off job security, and that's really what we found in the research, you know, at the time, and it continues to drive confidence patterns today. So I think, and that's why I focused a lot around the jobs challenge in my brief remarks today, because if we can solve that, if we start to see the jobs growth, particularly in full-time employment rather than in part-time employment, then I think that's going to be the catalyst to a broader recovery in the economy, because it'll lift the confidence levels of consumers and encourage greater investment ultimately down the track. We're a capital-intensive economy. We always have. Business investment has been the driver behind our growth profile for decades, and it has been coming off the resources sector. I guess that's why the diversification discussion is really important, because the resources sector is a great competitive advantage of ours. It's something that we should never dismiss or downplay, because we generate so much wealth and opportunity as a result of that. But we can't keep looking to the resources sector all the time to smooth out the cycles. It can't do that. It doesn't operate that way. And that's where opportunities in those other sectors of the economy can be quite significant and have a smoothing effect on our growth profile, which I think would be a welcome development. I think if we solve that jobs conundrum, then ultimately I think a broader range of recovery across multiple sectors will result.
Okay, so let's talk about the jobs conundrum. I mean, jobs can be, you can create jobs. The question is whether you create jobs that are sustainable in the future. Your point being around the mining sector and the mining cycle is that it's sort of cyclical, right? So to create jobs that are sustainable, perhaps that means that we need to really focus, or government to focus, on economic reforms, structural reforms to remove inefficiencies, to increase productivity, to increase wages growth and increase living standards. So, Amber-Jade, can I just ask you, firstly, what do you think government can do in this regard? What can it do more so? You have made a commitment on tax and regulatory reforms to remove some of these efficiencies, but how far are you really prepared to go on that?
Well, we certainly haven't stepped back from any macroeconomic reform. We are in the process of significant planning reform and strata reform. We've also implemented liquor reform, as well as taxing on-demand services. So in terms of reforming those sorts of industries, absolutely, we've been fully committed to doing that and are doing that. Job insecurity has been a challenge of governments for the last 15 years. This is not new. Mm. This is not a new challenge. And it is, it's really up to, it is a trend towards casualisation that we have seen. And I think there's an industrial environment federally that can help to manage that. But certainly regulation and reform isn't the only issue challenging the economy. It is about those external factors that we've been discussing today and our trading partners and how we're supporting those industries that we have in Western Australia as well. So as government is the largest employer as mm-hmm. well, we are certainly committed to and are actively converting long-term casual employees to permanent positions. So, and that is an ongoing work of government. It was a commitment before the election and we continue to do that. So where there's a demonstrated long-term job, then those people have the opportunity to convert that into a permanent job. And I totally agree that it is economic insecurity that prevents people from spending money, particularly in retail, that's the key driver, and that's one of the ways that we need to address that.
Okay, and Dean, what's your view?
Look, if I share it, I have a pet hate with some of the taxes that the state charges. Payroll tax, I find one of the nastiest taxes. We employ businesses for, we tax businesses for employing people. It's just crazy. But we're addicted to that revenue stream. We need to be using surpluses to drive microeconomic reform.
Okay.
I think that the latest reduction or lift in thresholds is tokenistic at best. We've seen a threshold shift to 1 million. There will be 11,000 businesses benefit, which is great. We want to see the businesses get those benefits, but mm-hmm. accounts for 1.1% of the anticipated payroll tax generated over the next 4 years.
Okay.
Or 8.5% in the growth of payroll tax revenue. So it's not nearly enough to drive economic stimulus back through the business sector. And so people might not be aware, but greater than 100% of the budget surplus is driven off two areas. It's the rebound in iron ore prices and the fix in the GST. It accounts for greater than 100%. If you compare to 15-16, the budget of forecast in those two measures was $4.35 billion higher this year than in 15-16, and we're on track because the iron ore price is holding up above $85 US against a budget of $73.50. We're on track to head towards well over $5 billion, towards $6 billion more than we received in 15-16. We're in a sense in the iron ore space in a mini boom, and we should be utilising that in a greater way to reform the things that are inhibiting business in Western Australia.
Okay. The very key point about any sort of reform is productivity, and productivity, as you identified, is one of our critical challenges. It has been in decline for the past 10 years. So as much as businesses have been adopting new technologies and innovation, productivity hasn't responded in the way that we like. And it is, in any economist's mind, it is the key to really breaking that stranglehold over low wages and increasing living standards. So John, if you can just explain to us, why is that happening? So what's happening here? Is it Is there some sort of structural change in the economy which means we can't extract those productivity increases as much as we used to be able to in the past? Or is it that we have, through the cyclical cycle, you know, we've managed to do whatever we can, we just can't do anymore? What's happening with productivity there?
Incredibly challenging question, and one that's difficult to answer simply. But I think it's a combination of both structural and cyclical factors that are influencing the shape and direction of the WA economy. Structurally, you know, there have been some big changes. There are global megatrends at play that are fundamentally influencing the way in which businesses have to operate and adapt. And that's one that no single government can resolve on its own, and no single business can resolve on its own. It's about its ability to adapt and evolve. So from a in terms of a policy solution, there's no silver bullet to this. There's ultimately a number of factors that can help improve productivity longer term, and it's that economic reform agenda that you talked about earlier, which tackles all the difficult issues from taxation reform to industrial relations to regulatory reform to microeconomic reform. All of those things are big, hairy challenges that aren't resolved by one level of government. It does require both a Commonwealth and a state cooperation, collaboration to make these reforms work in practice. Within the realms of the state and the state government, there are some important initiatives that can help enhance productivity longer term. That the investment side of things is a big part of it. The extent to which the state can invest in productivity enhancing infrastructure, you know, that does deliver long term gains ultimately for businesses big and small. It does have the financial capacity to start to think strategically around that. It has created a body which has been a welcome initiative called Infrastructure WA, which if it works right, will certainly start to direct available funding to those priorities that are going to generate the biggest benefits to the state overall and its citizens. So I think what it does come down to in the end is that we do need to have a bigger, more worldly view of what we need to do as a state and as a nation, and that sort of strategic agenda needs to be over time. It's a difficult one, particularly given the political cycles, and I don't envy that, because that is not one that's easily resolved internally. But if we start to look at those areas of opportunity, some of which we've talked about today, and think about it from a whole of state perspective, not just a single region, but a whole of state perspective, then we can start to make inroads into those areas where in strategic investments can make a difference.
Okay, I mean, certainly it's the case that we haven't been investing in capital to the same extent that we have in the past, which suggests that labour productivity can't benefit from the innovation and the technology. So it would be great if we had greater investment there, but it's not a one government solution and it's not just a business solution. It's really something that we do have to come together and think about that. I think we might just leave the conversation there with the panel, and we might head to questions from the floor. So if you have a question, would you please put up your hand? There are some roaming mics, and when one's handed over to you, please stand, state your name, affiliation, and ask a short, sharp question, because hopefully we have many of them and I'd like to get through them. So who would like to ask our first question? Okay, at the back. Getting there.
Hi, I'm Diana Vitasevich, Innovation Culture, and I work with CEDA Leadership Program. I'm particularly keen to ask the panel, what is happening in youth employment? It is a major issue. There are 18-year-olds leaving school this year who have not been over the summer holidays been able to find jobs. There are people with contract workers who have not had work over the summer period. Thank you.
Dean, would you like to start?
It is a challenge. Youth unemployment hit 15.2% this month. And a lot of the migration interstate has been our young people seeking employment in the other states. So it's not a great record for Western Australia. It does provide challenges. As we said, that retail sector is really hurting, which picks up a lot of part-time work for kids, but there are a lot of parents out there really worried about how their kids are going to get started. I'm one of them that worry about how they get a start in their career. And when we talk about broadening the economy, there's things that are occurring in Western Australia that are fantastic that we don't leverage. And one of them is the research. Like, we have great medical research. We have these other areas in the universities. And we tend to lose that IP overseas. And, you know, this is where can we help facilitate an environment where we can actually leverage that, gain that, commercialise that IP and actually bring it forward. I think we've got to start exploring these things because those macroeconomic headwinds that I talked about are really impacting what's traditional jobs, and therefore we've got to be thinking what are the jobs of the future and how do we create that environment here so that they actually, our youth can stay here. I don't have all the answers.
I think that's a very important point. We don't want a mismatch of the training opportunities versus the skills and the jobs that are required. We need those things to come together. So we need good dialogue also between the educators and industry. Yes, Amber Jay.
Look, I genuinely believe that education is probably the biggest intervention a government can have in anyone's life, particularly our kids' lives. And one of the first things we did when we took office was to freeze TAFE fees to keep TAFE fees steady, because we'd seen a huge increase in many of those fees for those courses. And we recently halved those TAFE fees for priority courses. So I think keeping education and training affordable is really key and an important part of that. One of the areas I represent has the second highest rate of unemployment in Western Australia, so I'm well aware of the challenges of unemployment and long-term unemployment. But for our kids, we want them to have hope and the view of life that they will be able to get on in WA. And part of that also is mandating local content in government projects through the WA Jobs Act. So we'll see a huge infrastructure program over at least the next 10 years with Metronet, the biggest expansion of our rail lines, and we will ensure that West Australians are employed on that project and that there will be apprenticeships available on those projects, as well as with manufacturing rail cars as well. So I think it's about education, also about providing those jobs as a government through investment in infrastructure.
Okay, great, thank you. Any more questions, please? No, we're actually very close to time. So before I close the session, I just want to quickly ask the panellists if there's one message you would like to leave with our audience on the economy. 30-second sound bite. Jared.
Just going back to the issues we've discussed, I think if we could do anything from a policy perspective, it would be on skills and probably on vocational education and training, an area that I think we've underinvested in for too long.
Okay, John.
To remain optimistic, I think we are at opportunity still. We need to leverage off our competitive strengths, but we should always be alert to emerging opportunities that are out there, not only in tourism and education, but defence and space. You know, there are a number of sectors that really don't have much of a presence that could be big industries for us longer term.
Okay, Amber?
That we're in a strong financial position and we're driving down debt, which gives us the capacity as a state to respond to the challenges that we see coming ahead.
Okay. Dean?
I think we live in one of the best places in the world and we're all very fortunate. And whilst we talk about the challenges, we've got to remind ourselves of that sometimes, that we are pretty lucky relative to a lot of other people in the world. But I think that we need to think smarter and differently about how we approach subjects. I think the traditional way in which we've gone about it is not providing the way forward for our young people and future careers.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Panellists, please join me in thanking our panellists. Thank you.